The controversy of my position is that no, antagonism is woven into the very heart of the absolute itself, and that this is what we see in Christ crucified.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. Hello and welcome to The Profile. My name is Sam Hales. I'm the editor of Premier Christianity magazine. That's the magazine that sponsors this show. And each week here on The Profile, we like to sit down with a different Christian to hear more about their life and faith. And my guest today is the Northern Irish philosopher, Peter Rollins. Peter has developed a religionless interpretation of Christianity called pyrotheology. And he's the author of a number of books, including How Not to Speak of God, The Orthodox Heretic, Insurrection, and The Divine Magician. He's a public speaker and producer who teaches that the good news is that we can't be satisfied, life is difficult, and we don't know the secret. He holds degrees in scholastic philosophy and political theory from Queen's University Belfast. And according to his website, Peter currently resides in Los Angeles and will die somewhere as yet not known. Peter Rollins, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I really appreciate the invitation.
It's great to have you. I first came across your work, I suppose, in the early 2000s, and there was a movement of church, I suppose, called the emerging church or the emergent church. And lots of people were rethinking God, theology, church practice. And you would give talks and you would write books, and it fascinated me. And here we are, 20 years on, and we finally got you on the show. So what took so long?
Wow. Well, hey, maybe you've been emailing me and they've been going into my spam, but I'm very glad that finally, after 20 years, it's happened. And it's funny, I love the fact you said, you know, that you actually read that first book, How Not to Speak of God. We're all getting old now. I mean, that's 20 years ago when I wrote that. My goodness.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to go on a great journey and just hear a bit about some of your story. I want to take us right back to the beginning. We always start on the show by hearing about a person's early life. And your background, you know, you grew up in a part of the world which fascinates many people, a complicated part of the world, let's say, Northern Ireland, with all of the troubles that went on. And I suppose I'd love to hear a bit about your religious and kind of cultural context growing up. What was it like to live in Northern Ireland at the height of the troubles?
I grew up, I was born in 1973, and so really lived most of my, all of my childhood into my adolescence in the troubles, which then kind of came to a close in 1998 with the Good Friday Agreement. I can't remember what age I was then, probably in my 20s. So it was all I knew. And it was a world where religion was used to divide. It wasn't really a religious conflict as such, you know, but religion was definitely used as a way to kind of like stir up division and violence. And there were a lot of peace walls. And I think that did impact my work a lot, because I'm very interested in how we often take our own conflicts, our own doubts, or our own uncertainties, and we project them onto other people, and we create scapegoats. And there was a lot of that going on in Northern Ireland. So that affected my work. I didn't grow up in a religious environment at all, really. My father was very quietly religious, a very deep kind of religious faith, but one that was very personal to him. But so I grew up very much in a, you know, secular environment, and didn't have much of an interest in religion until I was in my teens. And then I kind of got involved with confessional Christianity for a number of years.
Tell me a bit about how that happened, how you went from a secular household to one that was not just interested in God, but actually, as you say, you know, becoming a Christian. What did that sort of look like? How did that happen?
Yeah. So, I mean, in a nutshell, I had what is, you know, called a religious experience. And just to describe what a religious experience means, you know, a religious experience is not an experience of something, but rather what changes your experience of everything. So, you know, it's, you can do drugs for an experience, go to a football game, whatever. But properly speaking, when you look at some of their writings on the mystics, religious experience is not like, I had 10 experiences in my life and now I have an 11th one, but rather that all 10 experiences in my life are fundamentally changed. It's like You know, I like the phrase born again in a way. It's like, because you don't experience your birth. Your birth is what allows you to experience. So I don't experience my life. My life is the platform from which I experience everything. If I try to reflect on my life, I either become some sort of like a crude materialist or some sort of superstitionist New Age type person, right? You get into a Cartesian dichotomy between mind and matter. In other words, life is a form of revelation of the world. Our lives are a form of window or opening or unconcealment of the world. So I had one of those when I was 17 years old, and I didn't have a language to understand it. And so the language I took on was the language of the people around me at the time when I had this reconfiguration. And that was actually a charismatic evangelical church, who were very, and I'm very eternally grateful to them for helping me begin to construct a way of remaining faithful to and remaining open to that event.
So tell me a bit more about, I guess, what the experience was and what the language was at the time that helped you understand it.
Yeah, so, I mean, and this gets very to the core of a lot of my work, which is very influenced by numerous people. I'll hopefully quote, I don't want to claim any originality. Some people think of, conversion. Again, we'll use another term that's very popularly used. To convert is often thought of as to change from one position to another, right? Either from one religion to another, or from no religion to a religion, or religion to no religion, or even converting from one music taste to another, or to become a vegetarian or whatever. So conversion has this popular notion of, I have one identity and then I move to a second identity. But for me, the radical nature of Christianity is that Christianity is not and a new identity. In as such, it's identifying with the one who lost identity. So for example, there's a famous verse where Paul says, there's neither Jew nor Gentile, slave nor free, male nor female, all are one in Christ, right? How do we make sense of that? So at the time, if you were a sociologist, you could break society into Jew and Gentile, male and female, slave and free. You could say all sorts of interesting things about life expectancy and possibilities that are open to you, etc. But what's this idea that you can identify with Christ? Well, interestingly, Christ was the one who was stripped of all identity. So technically, the idea of crucifixion is that you're no longer part of the society. So you're stripped of all your rights, your legal rights. You're no longer a citizen. You're cursed of God. You're stripped of all religious identity, right? You're outside, you're in hell, the outside, basically the Christian is the one who enters hell, right? So you're outside the heaven of the religious system. And culturally, you're nothing and nobody. You're stripped naked. So you're reduced to bare nothing. So to identify with Christ means to identify with this curse, with this absolute loss of identity. So what happened to me, and this was your question, sorry, but I love podcasts because it's so different from mainstream media where you get 3 minutes to say something.
I know.
We can hopefully spend time. Hopefully you've got lots of time. I won't take all day, but we can, So what happened to me was that something happened on a Sunday afternoon, and I went home and I told my parents that I'm no longer their son, where I will come back. They were very gracious about it, by the way, very forgiving. But I got rid of all the stuff that I owned, and I stopped going to tech where I was doing computer studies, right? Now, what was happening? I couldn't understand it. So I literally had gone through a short circuit. I had gone through a rebooting, and I was finding it very hard to describe what it was. So what did I mean by those three things? Well, first of all, by saying I was no longer their son, it was a very inarticulate way of saying that how you've brought me up, beautiful as it was, how you're brought up defines who you are. It defines what you see in the world. It defines where you're going. And I suddenly felt radically disengaged from how I was brought up. So I literally felt like an orphan for a second. It was weird, just intellectually. Secondly, I got rid of my stuff, not because of some moral kind of giving to the poor, or I wanted to, look at me and I have nothing. No, it was everything I owned represented my values. And I was 17 years old. I had like I had a Transvision Vamp poster, my favorite artist at the time. You know, I had some stupid books. I think I had a poster of a car maybe on my wall, you know, very embarrassing things. But when I looked at all of my stuff, I just didn't see myself anymore. It was like, you know, your stuff is a mirror of yourself. And I couldn't see myself reflected. So I was like, let's get rid of it all. And then finally, I was on track to go into computers and get a job and that. And suddenly I felt, again, detached from those expectations of getting a job or getting married or any expectation. I felt suddenly like those expectations didn't mean anything. So the core is conversion was not an addition. It wasn't that beliefs were added to me or something, an added experience. Conversion was an experience of a radical subtraction, a libidinal disinvestment from society. It was like, to use a very overwrought metaphor, being unplugged from the matrix, where we are giving our energy to a system, and I felt unplugged. So that's what happened. But however, what happens is once you experience that radical unplugging, you very quickly are susceptible to anybody who gives you the alternative answer. And but thankfully, the people who gave me a way of understanding this, while I think it was sometimes simplistic and sometimes not great, it was definitely better than what I had.
The thing that strikes me about that story is when you have that experience of conversion, it was quite a radical change in how you lived. It wasn't just, as you say, new beliefs. It was, I'm going to get rid of my possessions. You say it wasn't a sell all you have and give the money to the poor. That wasn't the motivation. But nevertheless, there was a sense in which this is not just a new set of beliefs. Whatever has happened to me, this conversion experience is going to change the way I live.
Absolutely. Now, and the reason why I said, you know, it wasn't like a... Although St. Francis of Assisi, when he took all his robe off and became naked, again, it wasn't initially because he wanted to give to the poor. I think St. Francis of Assisi's original conversion was exactly this, an experience of radical disinvestment from the symbolic network that he was embedded within. And so, yeah, what I would say is, first and foremost, it wasn't epistemological. So as you say, it wasn't belief-based. It also wasn't moral. It wasn't that I was doing something for the good. It was weirdly, it was in philosophy what we call as, you know, ontological. And ontological, I mean, it was a change in my being. It was a change in how I interacted with the world. Now, then you have to build beliefs and build morality and work out what's good. But ultimately, this is ontological. Conversion, and actually, if I was very precise, you could call it deontological, because it was a form of entering into a loss of your being, a loss of yourself, a death. I mean, you could say it dialectically as you literally, well, you symbolically die, but that death is new life. And my work is all dialectic, so at some stage we might talk about that, but that's a form, is like, it's death is not an ethical thing generally. You might die for somebody, that's ethical, but death is not an ethical thing or a belief thing. Death is something that happens. And that's what it felt like.
I know that you've said in the past, presumably around this time when you joined an evangelical charismatic church, you were an evangelist. Is that right?
Still am, my friend, still am. Now I'm an evangelist for dissatisfaction and freedom from the tyranny of happiness. even when I started ICON, the Transformance Art Community, they always called me the evangelist because I'm excited about these ideas. But yes, you are right. I was on the streets on Saturday nights.
I know not all, but I know a lot of evangelists. I've done this with some of them. I've said, tell me the good news in 90 seconds. Yeah. And some evangelists will do that. They'll say, this is the good news about Jesus. Can you give me a sense of what your good news message might have been at that time we're talking about in a sort of short 60-second format? And also give us the 60-second format of what the good news is now, because I'd love to look at how you've progressed in that kind of short way of what was the good news for Peter Rollins at 16 and what is the good news for Peter Rollins right now?
Yes. Okay. Can I first give you a frustrating answer and then give you an answer that you might
Please,
more
yes.
want? Thank you. So my frustrating answer which is hopefully, I think, a more truthful answer, is funnily enough, my message at 17 and my message now at 48 is in some senses the same, which is when I was doing evangelism, because the events that I underwent was not to do with beliefs, was not to do with a change of my moral perspective or from one position to another, but was this experience of radical reconfiguration. I was purposefully didn't have a good news that was intellectually based, that you could speak, that you could say, because if I said it, you could either, if you liked me or if I was charismatic enough, you might be convinced by it, even if you didn't think through it yourself, or you could believe it, but it doesn't have any effect on your life, or you could reject it because you don't like me. So the thing about me is what I was trying to do, and at the time I did it through trying to invite a conversation, invite the person to begin to talk. So this is like a, like, you know, I wasn't doing psychoanalysis at the time, but you, one of the ways is getting the person to talk, getting the person to explore themselves, getting them into a place where they might want to invite this type of event. And in some respects, it's still the same for me. Like, I genuinely think that when you are talking about ontological change, a set of beliefs, as Soren Kierkegaard would say, he says, heaven is not a multiple choice exam where if you tick the right answers, you get in. Like, nobody thinks that, you know, conservative theologians don't think that, you know. So that was the frustrating answer. do you want the less frustrating answer now?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. at the time, embarrassed to say this a little bit, and I don't think I believe this very strongly, but I was probably inviting people into an experience of a new form of satisfaction. You know, so in society, we have the promise. I'm in Los Angeles because it's the most religious place in the world, right? Everyone is promising wholeness and happiness. If you have enough money, if you do the right drugs, if you know the right people, right? It's a religious mecca. And to my shame, I think very early on, I was dressing Christianity up as that. You know, you've got commodity satisfaction, you've got psychedelic enlightenment, you've got sexual liberation, you've got Gnosticism, you've got, you know, you've got political purity, you know, because we live in a political purity at the moment, revival of purity culture. But anyway, we have all of these ways to find certainty and satisfaction. So the world's like a massive vending machine. And I just put in Christianity as another product that promised certainty and satisfaction. Oh, it's not having a great job and a great partner, and that's not going to satisfy you. But Christianity is the way to become whole and complete. Now my message is that Christianity is an invitation into antagonism, contradiction, asymmetry. Christianity is not a religion of hedonism that promises to fulfill your desire, and it's not a religion of nihilism that promises to get rid of your desire. It is a religion of the absurd, in which we find a certain satisfaction in dissatisfaction, a certain meaning in struggle and sacrifice, a certain life in death. Christ is the figure of the absolute contradiction between obviously infinite and finite, between eternal and temporal, right? Between life and death, between God and humanity, right? But Christ is the absurd incarnation that invites us into a freedom from the tyranny of happiness, from the pursuit of wholeness. And can I say one thing about this, by the way, is that in kind of Gnostic Christianity, there is an idea that Jesus pays a debt, right? The debt is a lack. We have this lack. So debt is a lack of money, right? You have this debt and Christ kind of pays the debt. But no, Christianity forgives the debt. And to forgive a debt is different from paying a debt. To forgive a debt is not to take the nothing and fill it. It's to render the nothing nothing. It's to say the money you owe is nothing. So you turn a nothing that is something, debt, into a nothing that is nothing. And that's very, very key for me, because most people today in Los Angeles, for example, preach that you have this lack and you have to fill it with something. Whereas my work is all about, you know, how do we find a way to take the sting from that debt?
I think that's really interesting, especially what you're saying about, I mean, the prosperity gospel comes to mind, which of course a lot of Christians have big problems with, because they say this isn't true. This is creating false expectation. You know, Jesus did not die so you can be materially wealthy. That's not what the gospel is about. Mm. And clearly what you've just articulated would very much fit in with that. But what about the verses where Jesus does say things like, you know, I've come so you may have life in all its fullness? That might sound on the face of it like, come to Jesus and life will get better, which is quite different to what you're saying, which is, no, Christianity is not about making your life better.
Yeah. So, and by the way, yeah, and on the prosperity thing, you're absolutely right. Like, the only thing I want to do about the prosperity gospel is turn the critique up to 11. So that, because I think a lot of people critique the prosperity gospel, but then have a version of it. So all I want to do is kind of go, yes, you're right about your critique of the prosperity gospel. Now let's just turn that up a notch and we'll get somewhere else. So yeah, great question. Like, here's how I generally approach the text. I approach the text not as, right, a non-dialectic way of thinking about the world is where you've got, say, two positions in front of you. If you go to therapy, for example, you've got, right, say you've got sadness or you've got happiness, right? Everyone wants to choose happiness over sadness. That's obvious, right? You want to be fulfilled or you want to be unfulfilled, right? You're going to pick fulfillment, right? So we have these choices in life and we want to pick the best choice. Sometimes we try to find a middle road because we say, oh, we can't be completely happy. We'll find a middle road. Dialectics is neither of those. Dialectics is weirdly that you pick the worst, but you pick the worst and then weirdly you get the best. And so whenever you read the text, you're going to find these extreme expressions like fulfillment, like life in all its fullness, alongside death. An absolute sacrifice, and you have to lose your life. So what you find in the text, you don't find one, the good, and you don't find a blend, you find a dialectic between them. And just to give a concrete
example. Is that where Jesus says, if you want to find your life, you need to lose it?
Yes, 100%. Yeah, and by the way, if you read that and go, okay, I want to find my life, therefore, I'm going to lose it. You've turned it into an economic exchange and you've missed the point, right? This is the problem by economics is this. If you, it's almost like the parable of the pearl of great price is, imagine, you know, you come to this field, you find this pearl and you sell everything you have to possess it, right? So now on paper, you are incredibly wealthy, but in practice, you're completely poor, right? Because you've got nothing except for this infinitely valuable pearl, right? How do you spend it? How do you buy anything? How do you get rent? How do you buy food? So the person who buys the pearl going, oh, selfishly, like I'm going to be rich, they're the most poor person you could ever imagine because they've literally got rid of everything for the pearl. It's only if it's the pearl that you want in and of itself for its beauty that you become infinitely rich. Anyway, so one concrete example of this, because this can sound very abstract to people, is in psychoanalysis proper, someone goes into the analyst and says, I'm really depressed. I feel a lot of anxiety. I feel like I'm going to be taken over by a lot of painful things. I feel like there's this trapdoor beside me and it's got all these monsters in it. And I just need help in closing that trapdoor. But what does the analyst do? Well, they push you in. They don't close the trap door. They go, okay, tell me about it. Tell me about those monsters. Let's talk. And why do they do that? Well, they don't do it because they're sadistic. Maybe some of them are, right? They don't do it because they go like, I want to get into a job where I get people to talk about the worst things. They do it because it's only by going into the dark night of the soul that you find the light. It's only as you go into the cloud of unknowing that you find something that you can be confident of. I mean, even the definition of faith, it's fascinating. Be sure of what you cannot see. Certain, you know, it's, and in fact, I mean, Kierkegaard makes a big deal of this in Fear and Trembling, where he says the father of faith is Abraham. And Kierkegaard makes it so painfully difficult to like him. He goes like, you're saying the father of faith is someone who hears a voice and then goes and tries to kill his son. And he does this whole thing where he says, imagine you went to church. And you heard the minister preach about, you know, Abraham. And then afterwards you went up to the minister and you said, well, funnily enough, I heard a voice from God saying that I should kill my kid. What should I do? Of course, the first thing the minister is going to say is, don't do it, and you've got to go and see a therapist or whatever. So Kierkegaard kind of like makes Abraham look as controversial as he is. So then he goes, well, why is Abraham called the father of faith? And in a nutshell, I would argue that Kierkegaard is saying that Abraham fully embraces a dialectic, that he's fully going to lose his son and fully not going to lose his son. He doesn't fall into what he calls infinite resignation, where he's going to lose his son and not get the son back, or some sort of weird optimism. He is able to dialectically hold these opposites. And so there's something about faith, and Paul Tillich talks about it, that the certainty and uncertainty, that life and death, that light and dark are dialectically related. And faith is not about belief in God or anything like that. Faith is a mode of being in the world in which you're able to embrace disharmony, contradiction, antagonism, and experience that in a productive way. Oh, can I say one other thing? Sorry, and then I'll let you talk. Coming back to the psychoanalysis thing is, In psychoanalysis is very different from other forms of therapy, like counseling, very, very different from psychology. Some counseling, if you go in and you have a problem and they try to help you resolve the problem, or life coaching helps you try to resolve the contradiction in your life. So for example, you're clutching your jaw, so you've got a symptom. A symptom by definition is the bringing together of a contradiction. It's a compromise. So maybe you're biting your teeth because you want to shout at your partner, but you also want to keep quiet because you're afraid you'll lose them, right? So you've got this contradiction, and you go to the analyst, you start talking about the contradiction. Now in analysis, that contradiction is resolved by going into a deeper contradiction that maybe you wanted to shout at your parents, but wanted to stay quiet. So there's a deeper contradiction. And that contradiction is resolved by going into an even deeper contradiction, which ultimately gets into the place of, we are always between saying and not saying. We can never say everything we want to say. We're always caught in a type of hysteric mode of being, right? And then the cure in psychoanalysis is not when you overcome your contradictions, but rather when you're able to embrace your contradictions, say amen to them, and they are no longer oppressive to you.
Holier than thou.
Radical.
Delusional.
Ignorant.
Perfect. It's time to challenge stereotypes about Christians, and Premier Christianity is leading the way.
Transform your perceptions, broaden your horizons, open your mind to wide-ranging views.
Read interviews with politicians, theologians, and TV presenters.
Discover the breadth of the Christian spectrum.
Be provoked, react, inspired, and informed. Get the print magazine and full online access for just £4.95 a month. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com.
Premier Christianity Magazine.
The bigger picture.
It's interesting. I know those who have studied the biblical languages and cultures in depth tell me often that in Hebraic or Jewish thinking, you can hold two ideas in tension, two seemingly contradictory ideas that us Westerners or perhaps Greek-minded folk, we might want to kind of explain everything. I'm told by Bible experts that in Hebrew thought, it's very easy to hold two apparently contradictory ideas in tension, which of course explains a huge parts of the Bible, arguably, doesn't it? It explains why you can have one verse that seems to say one thing, another verse that seems to say another. That seems to fit in partially with what you're saying here, that Christianity is best understood where we can try and hold ideas in tension rather than trying to just resolve everything and explain everything.
Absolutely. Now, as a philosopher by training, I want to say and I'm a Hegelian, so I follow Hegel. Hegel's philosophy is a philosophy of contradiction. It's a philosophy of antagonism, in which he starts off by basically, if you think of reality as being comes out of nothingness, life comes out of being, consciousness comes out of life, self-consciousness out of consciousness, reason out of self-consciousness, right? If we say those are like some of the big movements in the cosmic history, Hegel would argue that each of these developments comes out of a type of cosmic asymmetry. There is a type of antagonism in reality, and the antagonism generates increasing complexity. Now, in modern science, we have names for this. So obviously in biology, it's evolutionary theory, the non-at oneness of the biological organism that creates complexity. In mathematics, we've got Gödel's incompleteness theorem, the contradiction at the heart of the axioms of mathematics that generate and sustain mathematics while maintaining its non-totality. We have with people like Niels Bohr, we have indeterminacy, which is the wave particle duality of reality. In psychoanalysis, we have the unconscious, which is not a thing as in Jung, but rather the unconscious is the non-at-oneness of the conscious being with itself. So, and in politics, it's called democracy, the non-at-oneness of the social body that generates, hopefully, civilization. So, but that, I would argue, is the religious or name for that is Christ crucified, right? Because Christ crucified is the ultimate contradiction, right? People are like Christians and atheists and traditionally atheists both find the death of God deeply traumatic. So for confessional religious people, God cannot die because God is eternal. God cannot die. And for atheists, God does not exist. So God cannot die. So the notion of the death of God that the Apostle Paul and Nietzsche, who both preach the death of God, that idea is antichrist, it's anathema. But I want to argue that it's not, that in the words of Karl Barth, there is no God behind Jesus, right? The death of God is the theological event of Christianity. It's actually why I call myself a Christian, because I think Christians don't believe in God, they believe in the death of God, right? Loads of people believe in God, even when they don't. Like, there's loads of people who get on the plane, and when it's about to, they think it's going to crash, they're worried that they're going to go to hell. They don't believe in God, but they still wonder if God's going to put them there, right? People believe in God even when they don't, and often don't when they believe they do. But the interesting thing, what makes Christians unique is the death of God. And that is the contradiction between what cannot die and what can, between the temporal and the eternal. When you wear a cross, you're wearing a symbol of the ultimate absurdity of reality. Tertullian talks about, you know, the absurdity of the crucified Christ. And all of this to say, I know I'm waffling, but I'm enjoying this. I hope you are too. All of this to say that I think this is not an embrace of merely paradox or of saying that anything goes, or we can believe in square triangles, or we can believe in, you know, God can make a Dorito so hot that God can't eat it, and all of these silly things, right? But it's actually more that antagonism and non-at-oneness is not simply in us. It's not simply in social reality. It's in the absolute itself. And by the way, the theological name for this, if you're talking about God, is Trinity.
There's an antagonism within God, which Christians understand as the Trinity, right? But antagonism, that sort of has connotations of conflict. I'm not sure if Christians would be totally comfortable saying there's conflict within the Trinity.
Yeah, so, you know, the comedian Dylan Moran, who you probably know, he once said, throwaway line, it wasn't a joke or anything, it was part of a joke, but he just said, war is the inability to have conflict, right? And I always thought this is a very good line, and he kind of went on about it, but you made a joke about it. But I know this from Northern Ireland, is conflict isn't bad. Conflict is when conflict feels, war is inevitable. Whenever you can no longer stand to be in antagonistic relation with another, then you want to destroy them, get rid of them, vomit them out. You know, you create purity cultures. And by the way, Christianity is one of the first systematic critiques of purity culture, which I say we live in a secular purity culture today. But so when I talk about antagonism, I do like the negativity of the word because it has a strength to it. But for me, it's a very positive thing. So even whenever you see, my God, why have you forsaken me, for example, you know, there's an antagonism to that. There's a kind of like, it's not, I don't know if you know Kester Bruin. Kester Bruin had a very interesting reading of The Prodigal Son. And it's very unique, and I think it's very brilliant. Whether you people like it or not, they'll love it. You'll love this because, you know, the great thing about a good parable is there's always new ways to approach it, like great art, it never gets old. So, you know, Kester said, well, this is a story about a son who's in a very wealthy family, they have everything. He wants to go into the world and explore it. He takes a share of the inheritance, he goes into the world, squanders it, ends up like at a trough feeding animals, then goes back to the father before to apologize and become a working hand. Before he gets there, as we know, the father runs out, shushes him, doesn't even let him apologize. He puts on the robe, says, come back into the family. Everything's the same. And of course, from a story perspective, this is rubbish because nothing really changes, right? The story ends where it begins. Kester goes like, well, Christ is the anti-prodigal, right? Because of course, when Jesus is telling this, he's telling the story of someone, you know, basically a heavenly realm. Jesus goes out into the world, into absolute poverty and destruction, and sees the suffering, then is put on a cross. And at the very moment when it's like he could just cry and the angels would come and take him home, he'd get his throne, his robe, and everything would be great. Instead, he refuses to go back. And he says, why have you forsaken me? Where are you? And the temple curtain rips and God kind of, you know, into, symbolically into the world. So there's this interesting thing that I think there is a antagonism. Obviously, we see antagonism in ourselves and in reality and political realities. But actually, what confessional Christianity does is it says, ah, but that antagonism stops short of the absolute itself. Antagonism isn't woven into the very nature of reality. It's contingent. And now the controversy of my position is that no, antagonism is woven into the very heart of the absolute itself. And that this is what we see in Christ crucified.
You mentioned a few minutes ago about how even atheists, you know, believe in God. If the plane's going down, they might suddenly worry, what happens when I die? What do you think happens when that moment comes? You said in your biography online, you live in LA and will die in a place as yet unknown. But when that time and place as yet unknown happens, which, you know, we all hope and pray is a long, long way away yet. When that moment actually comes, what do you think happens?
Okay, I'm going to give you a frustrating answer again, but then you can push me.
I thought you might, Peter. One of the things I like about you, and you've not done it yet in this interview, but I've heard enough interviews with you to know that you do something that Jesus does quite a lot. And quite often, people ask Jesus a question. You know what he does? He responds with a question. Or even better, I've noticed something else you're very good at, is you'll respond with a parable. So I hope at least one question I ask you today will get a parable out of you. But please, the frustrating answer and then the other answer.
Well, can I tell you my favorite parable of the moment, which does actually connect with this question?
Okay, great.
It has one swear word in it. You can bleep that out if you need to. Sure. Anyway, there's this guy, Seamus, very pious man, very religious man, and he loses his job. You know, it's the recession, it's COVID, and he's worried about paying his rent. He's not sure how he's going to make ends meet. But he prays to God, and he hears the voice from God saying, Seamus, sell everything you've got and fly to Vegas. So Seamus, pious man, he does it, sells everything he has, goes to Vegas. Hears a voice from heaven saying, Seamus, go into the first casino and put all your money on one hand of poker. So he does it. He goes in, gets the chips, puts his money in, and he gets 7-2 off. And he's like, oh, this is the worst hand in poker. What am I going to do? But he's got a fold. But, you know, but God says, well, stay, go all in. He has, obviously, he's got doubts. Go all in. So he goes all in on 7-2 off. And sure enough, he hits a 7 and he hits another 7 and he gets a 2 and he gets a full house. So then he can't believe it. He's looking around. He hears this voice from heaven saying, take all the winnings and go and play one hand of blackjack. And so he does. He puts all his money on blackjack. He gets dealt 16. He's going to stick. He hears a voice from God saying, hit. So he hits, he gets a 2, 18. He's about to stick. He hears a voice from heaven saying, hit. He hits again. He gets an ace, 19. And he's about to stick again, the voice saying, hit. He hits and he gets a 2. He gets 21, wins. Oh my goodness, I don't believe it. And then he hears a voice from God saying, go and put all the money on roulette on 7, the number 7. Seamus goes, he puts all the money onto 7 and he sees the ball rolling and rolling and rolling. And then it bounces, bounces, bounces. And sure enough, it hits 7. Seamus looks up to heaven. He says, I don't believe it. And he hears a voice from heaven saying, I don't believe it either. You're the luckiest I've ever seen. Right? Now, the thing I love about that parable is that we think that, you know, although we don't know and unknowing is within us, the universe is deterministic. There is no novelty within the absolute itself. But this notion is that no, novelty and surprise is hard-baked and interwoven into the absolute itself. Now, to the question. What was the question you asked?
There you go. So we've had the answer in a parable, which, as I say, is very Christ-like. So we can only applaud that. But the question was, what happens? What happens when we die?
Here's why I'm going to give a frustrating answer is, I think this question is not a religious question. I think this is a scientific question. I think it's a question. So obviously lots of religions have been writing checks about what happens after death, but it may well be scientists who cash those checks, right? So let's imagine, we're talking obviously post-humanism, transhumanism, but the idea that maybe we can extend life by, in the next 100 years, we're able to extend life by, say, 20 or 30 years. And then say within that 20 or 30 year period, we're able to extend life another 30, 40, 50 years. We end up in escape velocity, right? We end up getting to the point where potentially imagine, even just as a sci-fi imagination, a thought experiment, if you will. So the listeners don't have to believe this. Just let's pretend that we start to create technologies that allow us first to extend our biological bodies, then potentially download our consciousness into other forms, and then finally, maybe in millions of years, become pure consciousness itself. Because obviously, if you look at the trajectory of the universe, you start with matter, you have mind and matter, and then so potentially you can articulate a possible future of pure mind, right? So let's just say that for a second. So that is a question about eternity as a line in which you never die, right? That has never been the religious question. The religious question has never been about extending life, right? The religious question has always been transforming and entering into the eternity in the temporal moment. So within the chronological line, there is a inbreaking of an eternal moment. So Nietzsche famously retells the parable of the King Midas, who traps this demon and then forces the demon to tell him what is the secret to life. And the demon laughs a shrill laugh and then says, ha ha, the answer is beyond you. The answer is something you cannot attain because the answer is to never have been born. But the second best is to die quickly. Now, the interesting thing about that parable is, if you do not like your life, eternal life, as in chronological extension, would be pure hell. Heaven would be millions of people screaming for the end. Merely the continuation of life is not the deepening of it. So whenever you see eternal life, and this is, again, a very conservative position, when you see eternal life being talked about in the Bible, 9 times out of 10, it's not about what happens after you die, but it's about what happens before you die. Is life possible before death? I mean, Jesus even says, let the dead bury the dead. And he's talking about the literal dead, and he's talking about the symbolically dead. He says, we are the dead. He's preaching, how do the dead come to life? So it's almost like a zombie movie where we're all zombies and Jesus, the bite of Jesus brings us into non-zombie form, right? Interestingly, that show about zombies, The Walking Dead, was that we all have the zombie virus within us, which is called drive in psychoanalysis. And there's something about a claim. So that is a frustrating answer because you go, oh, he sidestepped it. I'm actually sidestepping it for a reason.
Yes, and to be fair, I think I can think of a lot of theologians again who would agree. I mean, this sometimes gets boiled down, overly simplified perhaps, but it gets boiled down to phrases like eternal life starts now. But it is that acknowledgement that actually, no, you know, Christians don't believe that eternal life is just this thing that happens when you die. There should be a sense in which that eternal life is available now.
I'm boringly conservative.
Well, you said you'd give me a frustrating answer, which you've done. But what's the other answer then? Because you must, I hear all that, but like deep down, there must be days where you think, hey, what does happen? The minute my heart stops, because again, confessional Christianity, as you've referred to it, has a very specific answer to that. It is that you will be face to face with Jesus Christ. Is that where you're at personally or not?
Yeah, no, I mean, that is never, the truth is, it's just not a question I think about. For me, now I'm thinking about it because you're asking me, but death has never been a concern for me because both possibilities are terrifying, right? The idea that you no longer exist is quite scary, but only scary in comparison to you'll continue to exist. That's quite scary. I'll give you a story very quickly. No, there's these elephants within this forest called the Lonely Forest. And in this forest, there are these ants, these angry ants. There's millions of them. And they have this ability to overcome large animals. I don't know if you've ever seen anteaters being overcome with ants, but I once saw an image of millions of ants eating an anteater, right? So in the same way, these angry ants could crawl into the nostrils of the elephant and into the mouth and consume the elephants from the inside and kill them. Well, anyway, the elephants had this great pact with these tree spiders, where the tree spiders would eat the ants if the elephants would stop eating from the trees and killing the spiders. And this worked pretty well. The spiders would eat the ants. The elephants were pretty safe. But anyway, one day, these two elephants wander out of the safe zone and they get surrounded by millions of ants. These millions of ants come up to them and start to kind of get closer and closer. And they're going, there's no hope. There's no hope. And then these spiders come down from the trees and go, don't worry, there is hope. There is hope. And start eating the angry ants. Well, this battle is going back and forth. The elephants are going, there's no hope. The spiders are going, there is. But it's obvious that the spiders are losing. It's obvious that the ants are overcoming them. And eventually the spiders retreat. And then the ants start crawling all over the elephant. And the elephant starts saying again, there's no hope. There's no hope. And then the spiders go, no, of course there's hope. And then the ants go into the mouth and start eating. And again, the elephants go, but look, we're being consumed. There is no hope. And one of the spiders goes, oh, you're talking about you. Oh, no, we're talking about there's hope for the forest. There's hope for life. There's hope that the sun will rise the next day and the species and life will go on. Oh, no, there's no hope for you. You're screwed, right? Now, I love that story because there's a certain sense in which I honestly think that when you enter into this new mode of being, this new ontology that we talked about, this new mode of being, your own personal life and what happens to it just becomes not as important as larger things. Now, this happens, I don't have any kids, but this happens, I've heard, when you have kids, that you think less of your own life and more of your kids' lives. And whenever you love someone, of course, you think more of them than you do of yourself. And I think that that is a sign of actually what happens as we become more healthy individuals, that actually we get to a point, I think the mystics talk about this, that our hope is for life itself, the life of others, the life of this continuing, ongoing development of the universe. And when you think like that, and this sounds like I'm trying to sidestep it, but I genuinely go, it becomes utterly irrelevant what happens to me. You know, it's like, it's who cares? I don't care. And that's why I like philosophy. See, whenever I read a book or something like that, I read a book and I'm caught up in the eternal. When you say 2 + 2 = 4, you're caught up in something that doesn't get old. It doesn't rot. It doesn't corrode. Thieves can't break in and steal it. Nobody can steal 2 + 2 = 4. When you say it, you are in the eternal. So when I am in philosophy, when I am in my practices, I am nothing. And so I don't. And then the short answer is I have no idea what happens.
Well, one of the nice things about my job is I get to obviously meet a lot of different people and do a lot of different interviews. And one of the things that brings them all together quite often is, and we get this from you, of course, is get a real lovely sense that a person really gets a lot out of what they do. And people use different language for this. Some people just say, I enjoy my job. Some people say, I am called to my job. Some people say, it's more than a job, it's a lifestyle. But whatever it is, that comes through with you, that there is, whatever the language is, but what you do, there is real life in.
I would die without it, by the way. I you know, what I do is it's life and death, yeah. You know? So anyway.
But I did want to ask, because I've never heard anyone ask you this before, and I've really no idea what the answer is. What does an average day look like for a philosopher?
it's really beautiful. I was on a podcast recently. It was a live podcast in LA called with my friends, the Minimalists, right? And It's funny because they do this section where they give practical advice. And I'm like, never ask a philosopher for practical advice. Or a psychotherapist, because that's my other training, psychoanalytic theory. Like, don't ask for practical advice. But the one thing that I enjoyed in the minimalist, like the closest I'll ever get to some practical advice is that the when you're a philosopher, honestly, the most fun thing is to think. And thinking is free. And like when, like now I, most of my, half my life I've been poor, and the later half of my life I've done well for some crazy reason. Like, I do okay, you know, even with COVID, I'm fine. But all through it, whether I was living in a squat when the past or whatever, is the things, a book and thought is so cheap. And I kind of sometimes think that when people work, the things that they work for, like basically say, for example, you need a holiday. And if, in order to have a holiday, you need to have money. And in order to have money, you have to work. But if you didn't work that job, you might not need the holiday, right? I don't do holidays because I love it. Or even with health, you know, I get sick. So I need, you know, I need to pay for the healthcare. And in order to do that, you need a job. But sometimes it's the stress of the job that's making you sick, right? Or even food, silly things like this is, I'm buying Postmates and DoorDash and all that stuff's expensive and I have to work. Well, you know, if you work less, you might make food from scratch, which would be healthier and cheaper. So anyway, this is just my advice of saying to people that the best thing about philosophy is, it's a lifestyle in which the thing you really enjoy is literally free. I will sit for hours. I'll read a little bit, and then I'll think for a few hours about it. And that's a lovely lifestyle. I feel embarrassed that I can live that. And weirdly, you can actually do this and make a living. Because when I did my PhD, I never wanted to go into university and never did. But you could never have made money as a philosopher, make a living as a philosopher. But now you can. But there's a golden age of speaking. You can set up a podcast. You can do lectures online. You can create a YouTube channel. That's exactly what you're doing, right? And not everybody can do it. Obviously, only a few people can make a living out of it. But the thing is, if you love what you're doing, then the living doesn't matter. That's like the death question you ask. It's like when you're embraced in the wideness of life, that question no longer is important. When you do what you love, the question of whether it will make money is no longer important. Yeah. I got teary-eyed there for a second. I want people to know that some of the best things in life don't cost anything. And I'm a living example of that.
Yeah, it's really interesting what you say about the first half of your life and second half of your life, because, you know, to be frank, I think the idea that it might be difficult to make a living from philosophy probably doesn't surprise most people. But I think the second half of what you say is more interesting, that actually, you know, you've been successful and you've been able to move country and, you know, you're doing this conversation and you're fully clothed and well fed.
Well, the only clue from the top to the middle.
But I mean, in all seriousness, I don't think people would necessarily expect that. So I'm just thinking, hey, you know, there might be someone listening to this right now who's, I don't know, 17, into their philosophy at A level, and is just thinking, oh, that's great, Peter, but how? How do you do that? Because I don't see many examples of people who get to just sit around and think for hours and have enough money to have a decent standard of living.
Yeah. Let me say something very encouraging. I want to be encouraging for a second to that 17-year-old and say, the chances are, if you try it, you'll feel terribly. It won't work and it'll be a disaster. And the reason why I'm saying that encouraging bit of information is because if you want it, that's one thing. Do you need it? Because here's the thing. Only if you have to kind of have such a hunger. It's like writing, you know, and it's, again, it's a truism. It's overwrought and whatever. But people say it's, you know, great writers don't want to write. They have to write. You know, there's something in them that compels them. And even if they were to live in poverty for the rest of their lives, they would do it. And I think this is important even for things like the environment. It's not that, oh, should I try and be good to the environment because it will have a positive effect? I don't know. That's very utilitarian. Imagine that it'll have no effect at all. Will you still do it? Is it something that's good in and of itself? And then once I've given that piece of encouraging advice, I'll say this is possible, really is possible. If 100 people do it, maybe only 10 will get to a point where they'll make a living. And maybe only one of those will make a good living, right? But all 100 of them, none of them will regret it. Because, and by the way, my happiest, I am no happier having money to having not money. And when I had the most money, which is years ago, a very kind, very beautiful family became a patron of mine. They had money, they had a trust, and they brought me to America, and they basically brought me from the poorest place in Ireland to this. They lent me a house in this beautiful place in Connecticut and just supported me for 3 years. And why was I saying? But that was one of the toughest times in my life. The money was not, it was because I was uprooted from my life. It was very difficult. And I was so happy in the environment that I was in. I was really, it got so much out of that other environment and eventually got lots of friends, and they're dear friends of mine. And now I live in Los Angeles. But all of that to say is what's consistently made me happy is the work itself. And I'll say one thing about that, which connects actually with everything we've said so far, is we often think that we want to overcome sacrifice to get to the thing that we desire. So there's things we desire. In work, for example, I might go, one day I want to retire by the beach, sit, drink margaritas and relax. So that's the objective desire, is to be able to retire by the beach with a little beach home. And the object that gets in the way of that desire is you have to save money, you have to work, right? But weirdly, then you get the house by the beach and you feel melancholic. So you've got what you desire, but you no longer desire what you desire. So in our society, we think that we want what we desire, but actually what causes us to desire it is the obstacles itself, right? So the healthy thing is to realize that desire involves getting and not getting, that what makes things valuable is sacrifice, is hard work. We don't want to get rid of work. We don't want to get rid of sacrifice. That would get rid of meaning. The more sacrifice, the more the meaning, right? That's why life and death become dialectically intertwined, because the ultimate sacrifice is death and the ultimate experience is life, right? So the ultimate, right? So the more you sacrifice, the more meaning and the more value you experience out of life. And what you want to do is you want to be able to enjoy your sacrifice, to find the sacrifice creative, to see it benefiting society, to see it benefiting the ones you love. Whenever you have to sacrifice and you don't see the benefit of the sacrifice, except maybe making a billionaire, get another yacht, right? That sacrifice is very painful. It's very bitter because you have sacrificed and you get some meaning from the work, but there's the value is being perverted. So all of that to say, when you embrace and do a kind of work that you love, that animates you, that is its own reward. That's not just some rubbish that someone says, you know, on a Hallmark card. That is a reward. But of course, the thing is, you're also more likely to be able to make a living from it, because people feel the passion, they know the passion, and et cetera. Sorry.
Oh, it's a wonderful place to leave it. Peter Rollins, thank you so much for coming on the show. I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. Listen, I really appreciate this. I appreciate your kindness, your generosity, and your willingness to tease out these ideas.
I'm Sam Howells, and you have been listening to The Profile Podcast. Really hope you enjoyed that interview. There's loads more where that one came from. Over 200 interviews with different Christians from all walks of life available now on The Profile Podcast, and new ones coming each and every week. If you have been enjoying these interviews, we would so appreciate it if you could take just 5 seconds to give us a rating and a review wherever you found this podcast. It helps other people to discover the show. So why not do that now? Give us a rating and a review, and we'll see you next time.